Hello again and welcome to another edition of the magical world of G. Michael Vasey. Well, I thought today what I would do was look at my assertion that the world is magical. And in order to explain this, I have to start with a little bit of a review of how things started for me. So they started when I was a very small boy. One night, when I'd been put down to bed in the back bedroom of the small semi my parents owned in West Hull, I recall watching a little blue man jump out of the mirror of the kids' wardrobe I had in there. As if that were not enough, this little blue guy pulled out a gun, shot me, and then leapt out through the window, through the glass, that is. If I'd been a bit older, I might have seen where things were headed generally, because my dad was in that room so fast I don't think I'd even yet started to scream. I was so shocked. He and my mother downstairs heard the bang of the gunshot. I still don't know what or who the little blue man was, or why he was shooting at me in my room that night, but I've long suspected he was a nature spirit, an elemental. The funny thing is when I wrote about this incident in my book, My Haunted Life, my mother reminded me that in fact the little man was green. So apparently my memory is wrong. She says that the little blue guy was a little green guy, and she said that I was very matter-of-fact, not frightened at all, and that I told them that I didn't want to move out of the room, but I didn't want to sleep with a little green guy. Such events continued in my life from time to time. It's funny how a small child sees things, and I saw a lot, it would seem. The world to me was magic, not in the way that all kids think the world magical when very young. No, I mean my world was magical. The dreams I had, the things I saw, magic. By the age of 11 or 12, I was reading voraciously. While I will admit to the odd Enid Blyton, the books I read back then were by Madame Blavatsky, Dennis Wheatley, and I'm pretty sure a guy called Franz Barden. I started attending a group at the local Methodist church called the Church for Spiritual and Psychical Research, or something like that. There wasn't a soul there under the age of 55, except me. And yet my dad was okay with this. In a way, he encouraged it, asking me about what I'd learned and discussing many things with me after these meetings. I discovered somewhere in my mid-teens that my dad was scared by the occult and spiritism. He did tell me why one day, and I understood at that point. It also told me something, perhaps, about where I got my gift, if that's what you want to call it, from. He told me that when he was a small boy, his mother, who was a medium, had asked him and his brother if they would like to meet her spirit guide. They nodded and said yes, not really knowing what a spirit guide was. He recalled that his mother literally changed into a Chinese gentleman sitting in front of them. Quite naturally, I feel, he wanted no more to do with such things. These and other such tales I told in my first book back in 2005, Inner Journeys, Explorations of the Soul. That book tracks my love-hate relationship with my innate psychism and continued fascination with the occult and the nature of reality. It talks about how I finally joined and studied with the Servants of the Light, a school of magic, if you want, in the UK, and what an impact that had on me, how I was able to finally bring things under a modicum of control. Since then, I've continued to chip away at myself and investigate this topic. Of course, many things have changed since then. The internet, quantum physics. It's easier these days to gain access to information and people. Easier to discuss, talk about, and yes, write about. Me, I'm still on a journey. When I was 6, 7 years old, I knew things. I didn't get these from books, the internet, or TV. It all came from inside of me and my dreams. In all honesty, I sometimes feel as if I know less now than I did then, and I know why. The world drags us in. It forces us to adapt, change, and become normal. It places us in stressful situations where, if we conform, all is more or less acceptable, whereas, if we fight to be us, we get into trouble. In the process, we're told what is normal, what is not, what we should see and what we shouldn't, what exists and what does not. So there you go. I'm trying to relearn what I knew when I was a small boy. I'm trying to relearn how to be a child, how to imagine with total clarity and see the hidden things, the magical things that exist all around us. In recent months, since I connected with the land and began a journey here in the Czech Republic into the Slavic gods and goddesses, I've somehow began to feel that magical world again. Coincidences, strange occurrences, dreams, all of these things come together and you find yourself wondering how. There's some meaning to this. And as I walk through the forest, I realize that I'm closer to nature than ever before. The trees, they're alive, they're spirits, they seem to be speaking to me. The grass, everything is greener. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, magical world. Well, as I said, I wrote about many of these little incidents and experiences that I had, some scary, some not, in the book My Haunted Life. And that book was made into an audiobook with the wonderful vocal talents of Alan Philip Ormond. What I'd like to do right now is play you one of my stories narrated by him.
Family Bible. "Come and look at this," my father said, with a tone in his voice I recognized as meaning it was something interesting. I walked over to our kitchen table curiously. He had a book. It was actually a huge book and leather-bound. "It's a Bible," explained my dad. It was a large and heavy, black, leather-bound Bible. It looked quite old, too. "It belonged to neighbors of mine when I was a boy," explained Dad, leafing through some of the pages. "Here, look at this." The inside cover of this huge family Bible was written in, and once I got used to the old-fashioned handwriting, I realized it was a four-generation family tree. Did it mark the path this Bible had taken through the family? As if answering my mental question, Dad told me that the Bible had been acquired in the 17th century and passed down through several generations of the family. That family was now extinct. It had died out with the recent death of the old lady who had given Dad this Bible for safekeeping. I found this Bible fascinating. Its age, the smell of the paper, the strange typeface used, the binding and leather cover that was embossed in a strange design. It was a mysterious book in many respects. We examined the book for quite a while, and then my father packed it in paper and took it up to the attic where it would stay at least for the time being. We thought nothing more of that Bible. In the days and weeks that followed, strange things began to happen in the house. It started with creaks and groans, unexpected bangs and crashes from the attic. "Just the heating and cooling of the rafters," my dad told us reassuringly. But things didn't improve, and if anything, steadily got worse. Nights were filled with strange sounds and sudden crashes that woke us all up. Added to some of the other things that I was experiencing at the time, it meant I hardly slept due to fear. I would lie there waiting for the sounds to start, and then when they did, I grew more and more jumpy and afraid as they continued throughout the night. Unfortunately, however, other sounds began to emerge from the attic. Deep sighs that sounded as if the most depressed person you had ever met just let out their last death rattle. Then there were the slow, dragging footsteps, punctuated with those horrible deep sighs of despair and followed by a few more footsteps. I wasn't the only one hearing these sounds every night, and I met my father on one or two occasions, armed with a flashlight, heading up to the vertical pull-down ladder into that little square hole in the roof at the top of the stairs. He was investigating those sounds, although mostly he just muttered something about me getting back to bed. The sounds were truly scary. Imagine if every night it sounded like someone or something was slowly moving around your attic amongst crashes and creaks, sighs and groans. The hair stood up on the back of my neck, hearing those sounds as the cold hands of fear seemed to clasp around my neck, slowly strangling me. As abruptly as the noises started, they stopped. I noticed almost immediately, and finally slept. No noises that night, nor the next, nor the next. In fact, the noises were gone and never returned. It was only several years later, when I happened to be talking to my dad about the noises, that an explanation emerged. "It was that bloody Bible, I'm sure of it," said my father, somewhat to my surprise. "Bible? You mean that big family Bible you showed me that day?" I asked. "Yes, that one. It always did give me a bad feeling. And that family never really liked us, so I wondered why we were given it. One night when I went up to the attic and found the damn thing, I took it down and placed it in one of those old biscuit tins, and then the next day I buried it at the bottom of the garden." "Seemed to work," he added, looking at me with a grin. Who knows if it was that Bible or what the sounds really were, but one thing is for sure. If one day you happen to dig up an old biscuit tin containing an old leather family Bible, throw it away as quickly as you can.
Back in my magical childhood, telephones were black and had a handset that sat on a body with a rotary dialer. They made a lovely sound when you turned that dialer. Like most kids, I suppose, I was obsessed with the phone. Every chance I got, I was there, in the porch, playing with the phone. One day, I guess I must have dialed just the right number of times. A number that really existed. I recall being a bit amazed and enthralled by the fact that someone said, "Hello?" It was a man's voice, and he repeated the hello a couple of times. I think I must have said something, and I suppose he guessed I was a small child playing with the telephone. "Who is it?" I asked. "Santa Claus," said the man. "Have you been a good boy this year?" I was a bit perturbed by that question. That was the $6 million one, wasn't it? I suppose I told him that I was a good boy, and he asked me what I wanted for Christmas. I gave him a few ideas. "Well, perhaps I can talk to your mother now and see what she thinks," asked Santa. I complied and went off to fetch my mum, who reluctantly and disbelievingly followed me to the phone. I recall she talked to Santa for several minutes. She had a smile on her face and was laughing, so it seemed all good news to me. Of course, I was gently admonished for touching the phone. She told me Santa was impressed and would do his best to bring the gifts I'd asked for. I don't recall if I did, but I do recall talking with Santa. I wonder who he was. I do know, though, that it stuck in my mind, and when I finally was confronted with the truth that it was all a charade, I couldn't quite believe it. After all, I'd spoken to him. Plainly, the 1960s were a much more innocent age. And in that magical era, when I was a small boy, I remember one day deciding with a friend that we would explore the very edges of our world. We jumped on our bicycles and set off resolutely in that general direction. After about 15 minutes, we'd already entered an entirely new world about which we knew only rumour. Here, there were supposed to be roaming gangs that if they caught you would carry you off to their secret lairs in the Black Gang. We felt, well, very brave to have gone so far and to be in someone else's territory. Parking our bikes by the side of the street, we entered some gardens, discovering a veritable paradise of willow trees and grass surrounding a small, private pond. It was magical, and it was someone else's secret garden. As we had hauled ourselves over a 6-foot brick wall to get there, to me, this was a secret and deeply mystical world. The grass and the drooping willows gently moving in the breeze stirred my imaginative juices, and I recall sitting there savouring the atmosphere. Of course, we were very afraid that whatever giant owned this garden, they would be miffed to find us trespassing there. So we shortly left, taking one last long look over our shoulders, hopping back on bikes and cycling down the street, just as fast as we could. We half expected to hear the thump of feet as we were chased down that street. We half expected to meet the members of Black Gang on the trek back. Of course, we arrived home safely and enjoyed a sandwich and fizzy drink in front of the TV. I recall this expedition with clarity. I recall the feelings and emotions. I recall the secret garden at the end of the world. It was a magical day in a magical childhood. Not so long ago, I had the opportunity to go back to my childhood house. A quick stroll up the street, one block, and I found that Black Gang was now a sprawling housing estate rather than the square of bomb-damaged wasteland it was when I was growing up. Another block, and I found a block of flats, and peering over the brick wall I was surprised to find the magical garden. It was much smaller than I recalled, and there was just one willow tree there and a small muddy green pond, unkempt and overgrown. You know, imagination is an incredible thing, far better than the reality we surround ourselves with. On the other hand, perhaps that reality is created through our imagination, in which case we simply need to imagine better, just like I did as a boy, just like we all did when we were kids. I'd like to go back to Alan Philip Ormond and have him read another story from My Haunted Life to give you a more creepy flavour of some of the experiences that I had as a boy growing up.
Poltergeist. Growing up in my house was, on the whole, pretty good. We had great parents. Almost every weekend we were gone camping somewhere. We had two proper holidays each year, and I have no complaints at all. Just a bunch of heartfelt thanks to my parents, and a growing sense of awe as to how they did all that with three small boys and not a lot of money. When I was 11, we moved. It was a good move, to be honest, from a terrace three up, two down in West Hull, to a rather nice semi-detached outside of Hull. It meant a better school and a nicer environment back then. It stretched my parents' finances a bit, too. It is funny, though, that my brothers and I really did not like that house the first time we saw it. It had terrible wallpapers, it was gloomy and ill-lit, very cold and damp, without central heating. Between the three of us, there was no excitement at moving there. Of course, within a few months, that house was completely different. Central heating had been installed, old fireplaces blocked up and replaced with modern gas fires, new wallpaper and decor, and new curtains. To make it seem more homely, a couple of internal windows had been added, letting much more light enter into the rooms as well. It was transformed. All was well in the Vasey household. But it wasn't to stay that way. The first incident was the Cavalier ghost. And after that, I swapped rooms with my little brother, giving me the smallest bedroom in the front of the house, but also the privacy of my own room. I gradually came to loathe that room. It started with the noises, strange noises at all times of day, but mostly in the dead of night. Scraping sounds and scratching sounds. Dad put it down to maybe a squirrel in the loft. I wasn't as convinced. Things would also move around. I would place my watch by the bathroom sink to get washed and find it in the kitchen. At first, I thought it was Dad having fun, as he was always a great practical joker. But it soon became apparent that it was not him. Keys went missing, money, too. These would then, just as mysteriously, turn up in the strangest places, like on a window ledge or under the sofa cushions. The next developments were what eventually had me relieved to leave and go to college. It was what kept me awake at night, in total fear. Have you noticed that silence is loud? I mean, when you are really, really focused on listening to nothing. It is very, very loud. I would lie in bed, head under the bedclothes, bedside light on, listening. The scratching sounds. Scratching sounds, and the sounds of doors opening that I knew were locked. The sounds of footsteps and breathing. It was enough to make the hair stand on the back of your neck. I would actually dread coming home from college for a weekend or the summer because of this. By the way, this only happened when I was there, just for me, apparently. I would literally go out and get drunk in order to stay there. The best example was one night close to Christmas. I was home from college and had been out with my friend and had a few. I was sleeping on the floor in my brother's room that night. I lay down, hoping to pass right out. But instead, I was cold stone sober and scared half to death by the sound of the front door opening. Now, the first thing I thought was that somehow I had left the door unlocked. But I knew that wasn't the case, as I had checked it on the way up the stairs. The key was in the lock, and that door was locked. The front door opened and closed as I listened, sitting half up in bed. There was a deep sigh and a little cough. Ice-cold fear ran through my veins. The silence was so loud, it was unbearable. Then, the first footstep and creak at the bottom stair. My heart was beating as if to burst. Another long sigh, and another step, and another. I was now fumbling for the light, but my hands were shaking so hard I couldn't find it. By now the steps seemed to be at the top of the stairs and moving along the hallway. The floorboards creaked, and there was that sigh again. I was frozen to the spot. But what I actually wanted to do was run anywhere. There was a moment's silence, and then I watched in disbelief and horror as the bedroom door began to slowly swing open. I screamed. I screamed so loudly you probably heard me in London. A few moments passed by, and then the door flew open. There, to my utter relief, stood my dad in his pajamas, holding a very large spanner in one hand and a flashlight in the other. He switched on the light, and my brother looked about him in a state of shock through two sleepy-looking eyes. "It's okay. I heard it, too," said my dad. "I heard it, too." We sat, Dad and my brother and I, for quite a while. But all was quiet. Whatever it was, it had gone. I eventually fell asleep, and my dad went back to bed, checking the doors and the progress. We didn't talk much about it the next day. It was simply something that happened in that house when I was home. My dad said it was poltergeist activity, and it was centered around me. I think he was right. We didn't really know what to do about it. But we did discover one thing. If I got angry, the phenomena stopped. So, that is what I would do. I would get angry and shout at whatever it was to get lost or perhaps use even more choice phrases. If a door started to open, instead of screaming, I pulled the door open with a verbal challenge. It had the desired effect. The activity followed me, though. It followed me to Aston University, until I met Anantha. But that is another story.
I recall singing a song when I was a small child and wondering, what did it mean? Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Where did this come from, this little rhyme, and who wrote it? A bit of research suggests that the earliest printing of it was in 1852, but who wrote it and why seems lost in the mists of time. If anyone knows, please do let me know. I thought life a dream when I was a child, or rather, I thought it was a game that I controlled. It was a sort of virtual reality, as it would be called now, and I was sat in a box connected to a machine that gave me vision and senses. So to be honest, I didn't puzzle too much over the idea that life might be a dream. I rather accepted that it was. I've lost so much as I've grown, and yet I've gained so much as well. My imagination as a child, as I said, was beyond equal. I could create other worlds right there in my head, and my dreams and my waking life seemed interconnected and one. I could fly back then. Magic, physical magic, was real, and so were elves and fairies. There was a girl I loved so much trapped on an island of towering cliffs, looked after by a wicked witch of an aunt, that I dreamed about over and over again. One dream ran into the next, even weeks apart, until I finally rescued my love, and the wicked witch met her destiny. I may have had unlimited imagination as a child, but there was no experience of life. It's as if we build ourselves a prison. It starts early with our parents who, knowing no better, burden us with some of the natural, hardened life material. Next, it's other kids, peer pressure, and our teachers, culture, way of seeing things, and so on. We lose our ability to just imagine, and it's replaced with the straitjacket that is normality and acceptance. We no longer row the boat gently down the stream, but rather fight the currents going in God knows which direction and to what end, oblivion? Life loses its innocence, its gaiety, its merriness. It's no longer a dream but a nightmare. That is until you remember how to imagine, how to center yourself and imagine. Learn how to dream again, how to cast off the horny matter of life's experience and transform these, no matter what they are, into something of eternal value and meaning, something spiritual and energizing. The combination of childish imagination skills and the adult's experiences of life to at first remember to row gently down the stream with the current. It's your dream, and you can create your own reality. Thanks for listening. Bye.